ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making its One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
War is chaos. That's why some leaders use it, as no doubt you've noticed.
That's right, Robin. And later in this science show, more on that possible chaos inflicted by the H5N1 avian influenza invasion you've heard so much about, and also on Lab Notes this week. But the biggest turmoil all over the world today is war.
Yes, here's part of an editorial from The Economist magazine. It says, bullets and bombs killed nearly 750,000 people in wars between 2021 and 2024. Many more died from the indirect effects of conflict, such as hunger and disease. Combat deaths in the past 4 years have been the highest since the Cold War. And for what purpose? Not even leaders who started recent wars can be pleased with the results. That's from The Economist magazine. And so in today's Science Show, we ask, can science offer an alternative view?
Hello, I'm Belinda Smith.
I'm Robin Williams, and today we'll hear from Professor Ian Lowe at Griffith University in Brisbane on some peaceful ideas for solving problems and what else we can do with the trillions of dollars wars now cost. And later we'll have thoughts about education, birds, brilliant brains, and then that other invasion, the H5N1 virus that's threatening our wildlife. Now, Ian Lowe is the kind of person who, like Tim Flannery, meets opposite thinkers to share ideas and solve problems in a friendly way. He once wrote a book about nuclear with Professor Barry Brook of Hobart called simply Yes and No. Barry was for nuclear, that's yes. Ian against, no. And there was a short volume for you setting about facts and choice. And now here's Ian Lowe, co-president of the Australian Peace and Security Forum, with his take on our present violent world and how to make it a more peaceful one. Before I ask you about that, I want to find out, are you still playing cricket for Australia?
Well, I'm still playing cricket, no longer for Australia. I've been pushed out of the over-70s team by younger men who are, to be fair, they are better cricketers than I am. They're probably better cricketers than I was when I was just 70. But I'm still turn out for one of the Sunshine Coast over-60s teams. Fortunately, they now have six teams, so there's still a place for an ageing veteran. I still enjoy playing cricket.
And as a fast bowler, of course.
Well, I was a fast bowler. I'm now a geriatric medium.
And apart from that, are you still singing in the choir?
I am indeed. We just did a concert of Vivaldi's works. We sang the Gloria and several of Vivaldi's shorter works, most of which I had never even heard performed. So it was a learning experience as well as a delight. I mean, it's extraordinary how much good music was written and often forgotten. I mean, somebody discovered a cello concerto that Haydn wrote in the 1960s. It was discovered in Italy, and it's clear from comparisons with his diary at the time that Haydn actually wrote it, but it disappeared for 200 years and then was...
How extraordinary. So you're having a full and active life. But going back to that question of peace, there's not much peace around these days, and is it because it's considered to be a bit woke? You know, peace demonstrations, people did that in the 60s, Kumbaya and all that. What's going on, do you think?
It's worrying. We all had great hopes that the United Nations would not have the mistakes of the League of Nations, which failed to prevent World War II. And you could argue that for 30 or 40 years, the United Nations was relatively successful in defusing conflicts. There weren't major wars. But in recent years, you know, whether it's Putin attacking Ukraine or Trump deciding to bomb Iran, we've really lost any notion of international order and international rules of engagement, and we're back to a sort of medieval primitivism in which even though I walk through the valley of death, I will fear no evil, for I am the meanest son of a bitch in the valley. That it's a sort of might is right, as it used to be in the colonial days. And the worry is that the people who are unilaterally attacking their neighbours now have nuclear weapon. And I was having a discussion over lunch just recently with colleagues about the fact that people are concerned that Iran might get a nuclear weapon, but no one is concerned at all about the fact that Israel probably has 90 nuclear weapons. And the worry about the juxtaposition of Saddam Hussein being overrun in a few weeks because he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, whereas world leaders tiptoe respectfully around Kim Jong-un because he does have nuclear weapons. The signal that sends to any tinpot dictator is if you don't want to get pushed around by the big kids, you should have nuclear weapons. And the more people have nuclear weapons, the more likely it is that sooner or later a leader will be deranged enough or desperate enough to use them.
In the old days, I hesitate to say that, but there was an idea not terribly long ago that if the scientists involved with all this technology of warfare, and there's masses of it in different ways, plus communication systems which allow any kind of harebrained idea to be around the world at the click of a button, if the scientists resisted that because it's clearly dangerous, well, it'd be diminished in its bad effects.
And in a sense, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists was based on that principle, that if the scientists spoke up about the dangers, then the leaders would take notice. But each year the doomsday clock has inched remorselessly closer to midnight, and leaders shrug their shoulders and go on as if nothing had happened. I mean, in a sense, there's a parallel with the concerns about climate change, the concerns about limits to growth going back to the 1970s, that if the advice of experts is contrary to the short-term priorities of politicians, they get on with their short-term priorities and ignore the advice of the experts. I mean, it's a bit like St. Augustine saying, Lord, make me pure, but not yet, because he wanted to get some enjoyable sinning in first. Even those leaders who are smart enough to realise that growth can't go on forever are desperate that it won't stop in their term of office. And I remember when our dear friend Barry Jones was science minister, he expressed the concern that in Canberra, a long-term thinker was somebody who looked beyond this budget, and a very long-term thinker was somebody who looked beyond the next election. But every day, politicians are making decisions that literally sets in cement what our priorities will be for decades. But it's all based on short-term priorities.
$38 billion for AUKUS.
$368 billion is the price tag for AUKUS.
I can't think that big, huge numbers.
Huge numbers. I mean, it's hundreds of times the cost of a new hospital. It's about what it would cost to build 1 million houses, you know, to ensure that there wasn't a housing problem. And I've pointed out to people that that's almost certainly a gross underestimate, firstly because no big government program ever comes in on budget, but also because it doesn't cost the problem of managing the radioactive waste from the submarines at the end of their useful life. And we can get some idea of how big the price ticket might be from the South Australian Nuclear Royal Commission. I was on their expert advisory committee, and they were proposing to the South Australian government that they set up shop to take in the radioactive waste from other countries in the region. And in one sense, it was quite a rational argument that we know that to be responsibly managed radioactive waste needs to be stored in a stable geological environment. But countries like Japan and Korea don't have stable geological environments. And Kevin Scarce, who was the former governor of South Australia, argued that it was almost a responsibility as an exporter of uranium to offer to do something about the problem of waste. And they commissioned an estimate of what it would cost to build and operate a repository to store long-lived, high-level radioactive waste from nuclear power stations. And they came up with a figure in 2015 dollars of $145 billion. That's about $180 billion in current-day dollars. And that's almost certainly an underestimate, because that was dealing with the waste from nuclear power stations, which generally operate on low-enriched uranium. The submarines use highly enriched uranium, which is weapons-grade material, it produces a much nastier, a much more impractical set of waste products. But more importantly, at the end of the life of a nuclear submarine, there's still enough to enrich uranium in the core for about 20 bombs. So disposal isn't just a technical problem, it also requires military security to ensure the fissile material isn't misused. So $368 billion is, if anything, an embarrassingly irresponsible understatement of what it is likely to cost to operate nuclear submarines and deal with the waste at the end of their life if this proposal actually goes ahead.
What would you like to see, say, Australian scientists do that would make a difference?
Well, Australian scientists developed, through Martin Green's group at the University of New South Wales, the most efficient solar cells in the world. And that technology was exported to China and is the basis now of the Chinese solar cell industry, which is the fundamental reason why solar electricity is far cheaper than any of the old fossil fuel technologies. What I would like to see Australian scientists and technologists doing, I guess, is more aggressively pushing our government to think about smart exports, exporting knowledge-based products, rather than, as Barry Jones lamented, exporting unprocessed raw materials and then re-importing highly processed manufactures, which, in a world in which smaller and smaller quantities of raw materials make more and more expensive end products, is inevitably an economic losing game. We are one of the 10 or 12 largest economies in the world. We have a very advanced scientific base. We really should be using that as the basis of our economic development, rather than continuing to export iron ore and coal and hope that we can buy the things that we're not clever enough to make, like T-shirts and sand shoes.
What about the nature of the human beast? Now, if you think back, Winston Churchill, he really struggled because he'd been there in the army. He saw the young men and some women, lots of women in nursing and various other situations, even way back then. And he was really torn during the Second World War, knowing that his decisions would result in the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands, of young people. Since Trump has been there in his second manifestation, it's been not only trillions of dollars spent that could be invested on all sorts of things, but hundreds of thousands of people dead, smashed. What is there about the human being that can tolerate such things?
It's a very difficult question. I mean, one of my friends said the problem with the democratic system is that almost inevitably sociopaths will gain power because they'll be more ruthless, they'll be more determined, and they'll be more effective at selling their vision. And in a sense, Hitler had some appeal to Weimar Germany because inflation was rampant, people were living on the bones of their arse, and he was a man promising to make Germany great again, to coin a phrase. And in a sense, you can see, whether it's Trump in the US, Nigel Farage in the UK, the even more improbable Pauline Hanson in Australia, people are unhappy. They can see that what's being done isn't working, and they're looking for an answer. They're looking for something different. And I find it difficult to understand how Americans fell for Trump a second time. I mean, you can sort of understand how, with things going badly and the Democrats not offering anything different, they were prepared to elect him once. But given that by 2024 they actually knew about him and they still re-elected him, I mean, it really is a worrying reflection, I guess, on the human condition and on education. I mean,
you flood the zone. And you're making education that much more difficult because you've underinvested perhaps in schools, and the poor teachers have to keep control over rambunctious people throwing furniture instead of doing the teaching.
I agree. I mean, I was a school teacher for some time, and one of the things that concerned me with the lower level classes was that the curriculum required me to teach science that was of no conceivable relevance to them. And so for them, the only joy in a science class was making life difficult for the science teacher. And I felt that I was really a custodian rather than an educator. And that's partly because, you know, when one of the young men who was about to leave school and become an apprentice butcher pointed out to me that what I was teaching them could not conceivably be of any benefit to him in the future. And I remember arguing with a science teachers association in this state for a reform of the science curriculum. I said that we should organise junior science around teaching people about their own body, teaching them about their immediate surroundings, about their need for nutrition, the need for clean air, the need for a pleasant temperature, the need for recreational facilities, the need for physical activity, rather than memorise the insoluble chlorides or memorise the first 20 elements of the periodic table, which was really just an academic hurdle. The reward for jumping over being the chance to jump over bigger hurdles next year.
But I must say that having talked to a number of high-achieving young people at school, they say, look, we don't want all this stuff that is supposed to be recognising our heritage. We know about our heritage. We want the curriculum so we can pass, so that we can get on with it and concentrate on achieving some sort of professional ability. But let me just talk about where we are. We're sitting in a pub in East Balmain, and you've just finished a lunch with a number of people who have been in various ways running universities. Any bright ideas out of that?
Well, there's a certain amount of dismay about what's happened to universities in our lifetime. One of the people at the lunch reflected on the fact that being on the council of a particular university at the time, it was a council of about 40 people, which included elected graduates, elected students, elected staff members, and there really was a sense that you were charged with managing a body of learning. But the reforms that the government has driven in the last 20 years have been treating universities more like businesses, having smaller governing bodies, more external people, business leaders, and we see at the Australian National University where that leads, a governing body that's totally out of touch with the idea of the university as a community of scholars, a place where there's creative learning, where academics are encouraged to act as the conscience and critic of society rather than encouraged to recruit as many full fee paying overseas students as they can. And I think many more people are now going to university, but I struggle to believe that they're actually getting as good an education as you and I got in the time when we were students.
I was touched actually to see the great jurist Michael Kirby was amongst you today.
Indeed, Michael Kirby was in student politics at the same time as I was, and I was telling someone the other day that as an undergraduate student in law, he gave speeches that sounded like a judge of the High Court delivering a minority verdict.
Next thing you know, he's on the High Court.
Yes, it was always precise and well documented. But I was reflecting that in the 1960s, the way universities operated meant that people who had a broader vision than organic chemistry or medieval French church history could engage with the broader issues. So student politics at the time was concerned about apartheid, it was concerned about the war in Vietnam, it was concerned about the development of nuclear weapons and their testing in the Pacific, it was concerned about the treatment of the first Australians. And the way universities ran, that teaching was on a one-year basis, and so you could sort of slack off during the middle of the year and you could get involved in student politics or drama or debating or other activities, music, and then sort of come with a wet sail at exam time. But the universities are now around semesters or even trimesters, so there's hardly a week goes by where students don't have an assessment item. So student politics and student involvement in activities like drama and debating and music has almost collapsed. Mm. So they might know more physics than I did when they graduated, but they have much less of a sense of how that physics is socially contextualized and socially driven, and even the idea that it might be used to benefit the community seems to escape their attention.
One last comment from me before I ask you something else. On another day, I'll just mention one of the most recent creations has been Friends of Evidence. And that's come out of the Science Media Centre and the Finkels, Alan Finkel,
yes,
and Elizabeth Finkel.
Yeah.
And she's written a book called Prove It. And this argues against there being simple statements about how you should drink Dettol and you get better. You know, what is the evidence? What do you need? And there are various ways that young people could be involved in that sort of exercise to find critical thinking.
That's absolutely the case. There's far too much evidence-free policy based on a whim or a half-baked idea. I mean, the AUKUS agreement, I think, doesn't stand any sort of scrutiny. I actually heard someone who was described as a defence expert saying that we need submarines to protect our shipping lanes. Now, the vast majority of our shipping is to and from China, and the only navy that could conceivably interrupt our shipping to and from China is the Chinese Navy. Now, it doesn't pass even the most superficial analysis to suggest that the Chinese Navy might be wanting to stop us sending material to China and getting manufactured goods back from China, but that's being advanced as a serious reason for us to spend an eye-watering sum on 8 nuclear submarines.
Emeritus Professor Ian Lowe is a co-president of the Australian Peace and Security Forum, and I am reminded of a cartoon in a newspaper long ago showing a frantic young boy shouting to his parents, "Mummy, Daddy, Charlie has written a very, very naughty word." And behind him on the wall was the single word, peace. A double meaning there, I think. The Science Show on ABC Radio National. And so to a couple of thoughts about that education Ian Lowe mentioned, connecting it more to the pupils' lives. Here, again, is Chloe Kwan, 15, now at high school, but once less keen on science at primary.
To foster a real interest in science, a very real and very important strategy that we can include in science classes immediately is actually mentioning how science branches out into other subjects. From experiences around me throughout science education in the present day, my friend was genuinely uninterested in science, dozing off in class and continuously asking me how I found this stuff interesting, until our physics unit on sound and light, where they basically lit up because it was related to something that they were interested in and passionate about. There's even a quote from my other friend which says, "Person X started talking about how interesting and cool science seemed after spending 3 terms talking to person Y and doodling." This switch up isn't a coincidence. It comes from a place of interest, and if teachers can expand on how science contributes to so many other parts of the world, not just quantum mechanics and flowers in a field, we can get so many children to realise that they aren't stupid or not fit for science, but they are just different kinds of scientists. This would not only allow for more children to choose science as a subject, career and interest, but would foster a lifelong skill that would transfer into every other field, experimenting, questioning and actually thinking. If this variation in topics occurred in primary school, we would be allowing not only the scientists to bloom, but also every other musician, soccer player, poet, and artist to blossom in their own right, using knowledge that they learnt from science, their own beautiful careers. Just how amazing is that? Teachers would be speaking to every child, not just for the nerds, to listen. We could finally have a world where if I asked someone to picture a scientist, they would, without a doubt, picture themselves. And these steps and initiatives will surely accompany many throughout their lives, making every cook, writer, musician, sports player, and scientist better. Through these strategies and identifying key issues, we are building universal foundational skills for all of our children, creating critical thinkers, world leaders, and groundbreakers. Let's have the writers know why syllables matter, the musicians understand sound waves, and the soccer players understand the physics of their kicks. Making science accessible and integrated is what keeps science alive outside of white coats and labs. It's what keeps science in us and what could keep science in you.
Chloe Kwan at high school. She's 15. A second example of flexibility in education, as hinted by Ian Lowe. Now meet Jennifer Baker, superstar of STEM.
I'm Jennifer Baker and I'm a research fellow at the University of Wollongong working in medicinal chemistry.
What do you think of the new Vice Chancellor?
He's actually really, really nice.
How did you get into science yourself?
I actually was stereotypical first in family. No one in my family had ever been to university before. Very, very public school background, and had a baby the year out of my HSC. So it kind of looked like I wasn't really going to be doing much in the way of a career. But when my kids were a bit older, I've got two adult kids now, was an ad in the newspaper about a bridging program to get into a university course. And I went along thinking, I'll just get a job that's, you know, 9 to 5, pays a decent wage. And one of my first lectures was a chemistry lecture. And the lecturer was teaching us about the different calculations that are done in chemistry. And she said, these are the sort of calculations that the people that cure cancer do in the lab every day. And that was like a light switch moment for me. I was like, wow, that could actually be me. I could go from working in hospitality, which is what I did for years, to actually contributing to curing cancer one day. And that was what I did. That was my path then. I finished my undergrad in science. I did honours. I did my PhD in medicinal chemistry. And I've been working on anti-cancer drugs ever since.
Any success?
I wish I could say yes. I think it was Isaac Newton who once said that all scientists stands on the shoulders of giants, and I like to think that maybe someday my work will go on to find the cure for cancer.
Back in the beginning, when you first were attracted, you weren't put off by all that glassware and all those liquids and, you know, titrations and so on.
That's the fun part. Getting into the lab and doing the fun stuff, yeah. If you get a little bit of a bang or a little bit of fire, that just makes it more exciting.
Do you still do that?
I do, yeah, every day.
What aspect of cancer are you working on?
So I'm looking at a particular protein that's prevalent in brain cancer, so glioblastoma. So we're trying to work out a way to switch that protein off, because glioblastoma is one of those cancers that isn't curable. Surgery is the golden switch when it comes to cancer, so a lot of brain cancers can't be operated on. So we need effective treatments to turn them off some other way. So that's what we're looking at doing, finding a drug that will switch off those cancer cells.
And of course, that university has got a tremendous reputation at the moment with a certain Australian of the Year or two.
We do, yes. We've got some amazing researchers there. Really, really amazing work coming out of there. I feel spoiled for choice every day when I turn around and look for a collaborator.
It's quite interesting. In the ABC, we have a tradition of the Andrew Olley lecture based on our dear friend, long departed over 26 years ago, when he died of similar sort of cancer, and he didn't know he had it. And so we're trying to raise funds for that kind of research, which really is tremendously complicated because you don't want to invade the brain. How do you get rid of that little patch there which you can identify and which otherwise will grow? It's really a challenge, isn't it?
It is absolutely a challenge. And brain cancer is one of the most challenging to treat. So essentially what we're trying to do when we make an anti-cancer drug is design something that will target a particular protein. And the good thing, I'm saying that with inverted commas, about cancer is that what sets them apart from other cells is that they reproduce at rates much, much faster than any other cell. So if you can find a drug that will target that particular protein, you really have the chance of being selective towards the cancer cells. The big issue with brain cancer is you've got this amazing coating around your brain called the blood-brain barrier that is fantastic at stopping things from getting in there. So when we're looking at creating anti-cancer drugs for brain cancer, we've got that extra level of difficulty in trying to actually penetrate that barrier.
And sometimes you can actually fool it by having a Trojan horse, or in fact a Trojan cell, which carries it through for you.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that we're looking at doing is we've actually come up with some amazing drugs that are really, really selective and potent towards this particular protein. But the problem is that they're not very good at getting across the cell membrane. So I've actually had a student this semester who's been looking at attaching different things to these drugs so that a cell will not recognise them as a drug and will just recognise them as part of itself. And we're hoping that that approach down the track will help us get across that really challenging brain barrier as well.
And as a superstar of STEM, what are you going to do?
I want to get my story and the science I do out to as many female and female-identifying people in schools as I can, to see that you can do what you are absolutely passionate about and it's never too late.
Jennifer Baker, University of Wollongong. And so for our final example out of the many going on around Australia is Nell Pearson from Northern Queensland, where they first staged E equals MC squared the musical, with very young children on stage playing legendary figures such as Einstein and Lisa Meitner, as in David Badanis's book of the history of that equation. Something to inspire kids in the bush and regions.
One of the objectives we had, Robin, with our primary school science program is a curriculum we developed, and it's offered for free by goodtogreatschoolsaustralia.com, the organisation we have in Cairns. One of our aims with developing that curriculum was we want to increase the participation of Indigenous kids in science. We want to give them the confidence to start in primary school and to continue in secondary school to see science-based subjects as a pathway that is for them as well. It's not just for the smart white kids. It's for Aboriginal kids to envisage careers in science as well. And girls. That was our second focus. We want to increase the participation of girls in science. So they were our two objectives with our science
program. Is it working?
It is working. You know, our kids who performed in 2022 during the pandemic, our actors who were in grade 6 at the time are now in grade 10 at boarding school in Brisbane. So these kids who were our performers in grades 4, 5, 6 are now in grade 9 and 10 in southeast Queensland. Our science program has been a great success. It's one of the things I'm really proud of because I was a kid at that very school. What we're giving the kids now is precisely the kind of education that I would have loved to have had in science when I went to my old school. You know, the school was strong with English, strong with math, but the science was lacking. And I've been very determined to remedy that, to make sure that these children have a taste of science. And by the time they leave primary school and go off to college, they're going to really actively choose science subjects in high school and see science as a real possible pathway for themselves.
Yeah, but looking at the musical again, you've got Emily du Châtelet, the most brilliant, wonderful woman. She and Voltaire, her boyfriend,
yes,
brought the Enlightenment to the whole of Europe. You know, these are megastars.
Absolutely.
And Michael Faraday,
yes,
you know, the genius, who's a bookbinder, a working-class lad, and as he was binding the books, he started reading them, and then he had brilliant ideas and worked out electric behaviour and fields.
Yes.
And these people are the superstars, you know, original science of the second stage. Do they feel in any way disconnected from them because they're from foreign countries far away, or is it the ideas that connect them inevitably?
The ideas connect with the kids. But, you know, my favourite, and I see the performance at Haberfield was really poignant, about Lisa Meitner.
Oh, yes, who was diddled out of her Nobel Prize by a Nazi.
Dudded from her Nobel Prize by that Nazi guy.
Yeah.
And the song that David and Chris Cohen wrote for it is very poignant about her situation because the kids are singing, you know, we don't want to frighten you, Lisa Meitner, about what's coming around the corner. And of course, she has to pack her bags and go off to Norway because the Nazis have come to power in Germany.
Yeah.
And she's expelled. So it is just a fantastic story in that David Badanis book. And, you know, 20 years later, I have this privilege of seeing someone like David come along and turn it into a musical.
And what's your next project after that? How do you follow E equals MC squared musical?
I always threaten my people that I've got crazy projects in the pipeline. We're now on the cusp, and I'll come back and talk to you about it, Robin, of getting into high school. I think we can do a lot more. So that's our next frontier, really, is to build on the work we've done at the primary school level to address the need, particularly in places where we come from. You know, we want the high schools that are out in the bush, in these small country towns, in remote areas. We want those high schools to furnish the children from those places with the opportunity to learn science like their brothers and sisters in the cities do. Hey, Robin, good to be on your show, mate.
Thank you so much. Noel Pearson of Hope Vale in northern Queensland. And there, Bell, just a few reminders of how schools may be more connected to civics and the world we live in. As for our wider natural world, what about that virus? Why should so many species be vulnerable?
Yes, it's a real worry, Robin. So based on what we've seen overseas, the H5N1 virus infects and kills many wild birds, as well as some mammals, most of which tend to be predators or scavengers eating infected animals. So what is being done to protect Australian mammals, such as the eastern quoll, which is a scavenger and already endangered? Amy Briggs visited Mulligan's Flat, a wildlife sanctuary in Canberra, where Dean Maxworthy and his crew are getting ready for bird flu's arrival.
So the whole idea is to be able to catch them up, put them into captivity for maybe 3 months. We're not really sure yet on how long it will be, but the whole idea is to quarantine them from the bird flu so that they can't actually catch it or minimise the chance of them catching it. It's literally a backup in case the population does get eradicated out there. If it did, then we do have our foundations to start again.
Why have you chosen the quolls to protect over some of the other species in the sanctuary that could be at risk?
The three species that the government has invested in are the Tasmanian wedge-tailed eagle, the eastern quoll, and the New Holland mouse, the piquilla, which is also an animal that we do have here. So with the wedge-tailed eagle, there is one place that I know of doing a really good job of having an insurance population for the Tasmanian wedge-tailed eagle. There's also really good insurance populations of the piquilla as well. So there's other animals that have that support there. Not to say the eastern quoll doesn't have insurance populations as well. There's definitely insurance populations in Tasmania and around mainland as well. But eastern quolls are probably going to be in the sanctuary in Mulligan's Flat. They are more than likely going to be the ones affected the most by the bird flu.
Mulligan's Flat is currently home to around 200 eastern quolls, which live in an area that's free of cats and foxes. But with bird flu now well and truly confirmed on mainland Australia, Dean needs to start thinking about gathering an insurance population of these feisty little marsupials.
We're not entirely sure how many we will house. It depends on what time of year. So breeding season's around winter every year. So breeding season-wise, if we catch them up then, we're not going to be able to house many quolls together at all. Once the females come into estrus, males will fight with each other over females because the smell of the estrus will just make them more aggressive towards each other.
What's estrus?
Estrus is essentially the animal going into heat. So it means the female's getting ready to mate, and when the estrus and the smell is in the air, the males will start fighting, and also females, especially once they have young, will fight with other females as well. From pretty much through winter until the end of the year, housing quolls together is definitely going to be a lot harder, whereas at, say, start of the year, it's going to be a bit easier to house them together.
When the time comes to start catching quolls, Dean and his volunteer group need to be selective about who they choose to take.
So we can target specific quolls, not just put traps out there randomly and hope we get what we want. And then there's the ratios as well. How many males do we want? How many females do we want? But that's still the question, is we're not still exactly sure yet.
And as it's currently breeding time, this could throw a spanner in the works.
If we are capturing quolls around breeding season. So mum's gonna still leave the joeys in the den to go out and find food. And if we capture mum, then the joeys are gonna be left in the den. So we don't really wanna be taking mum away from the joeys for two reasons. One, obviously the joeys will not make it. And two, the females will be lactating and end up with mastitis and all sorts of things. So yeah, breeding season's definitely going to make it a little bit more tricky, but this is what I mean by making sure that we are targeting specific quolls. We can make sure that them sorts of things don't happen, because obviously we're trying to save them as much as we possibly can. We don't want to be putting them in jeopardy that way.
So once the right mix of quolls is captured and no joeys left behind, each enclosure will house around 6 quolls. They're planning on making 14 enclosures, each around about the size of 2 standard car parks.
Where the enclosures meet each other, the idea is to have actually a little access door there. So if there was a bit of tension there, we could open up to give them a little bit more room between them. A lot of it is probably going to have to be taken back to bare earth, but then we are planning on putting log hollows and, yeah, try and keep it as natural as possible. Maybe even some little holes in the ground where they can tunnel into the ground and get under rocks and all them sorts of things. So trying to really mimic how it would be out in the wild. And even though eastern quolls aren't as arboreal, they don't spend as much time in the trees as, say, the spotted tail quoll, their cousin, we still have some perching and stuff in there for them to climb around on, because these guys can definitely climb for their mental well-being as well. They feel safer.
They need their little personal space.
Exactly. Yeah, 100%. 100%. Yeah.
Has someone else done this? Has someone doomsday prepped already and you can just copy it, or is it...
Maybe not. Well, yeah, I guess doomsday is definitely a word you could use for sure. But yeah, there's definitely other facilities that have gone with the same sort of design of just having enclosure next to enclosure to house animals in an emergency response situation, which is essentially what this is. It's just something that we haven't really dealt with before, the bird flu.
Even if sick birds can't physically get into the enclosures, there is another way the virus might infect the quolls. Bird poop falling into their dinner.
Our roof is actually made out of mesh, so that does mean that birds could potentially defecate into the enclosure, which isn't overly ideal. However, eastern quolls do really enjoy coming out and being in the sun. To have a proper roof over the top, they're not going to get any UV rays, and a lack of vitamin D is going to be quite detrimental to them. So ways of trying to mitigate this is trying to deter the birds with maybe even scarecrows or something like that. We're not really sure yet, but having shade cloth over the top of the roof as well. And then also having a place where we feed the quolls, which is undercover, so the quolls' food is not getting contaminated by bird scat.
If the worst does come to pass, and the only remaining eastern quolls are those that have been kept in these doomsday dens, the hope would be that reintroduction is possible within the sanctuary. It could be a couple of months or even years before it's safe enough to release insurance quolls. But the truth is, there's so much we don't know about how the virus will act, like if it will come and go in waves, what species will be affected, and there's no plans for a quoll bird flu vaccine. Dean would like to try to protect other species too, but the organisation is limited by funding.
And that is definitely the hard bit. In conservation, you don't really want to have to pick and choose which ones you save and which ones you don't. I guess it just all comes down to what you can do. And the eastern quolls are a very important part of the ecosystem out there. And a lot of work has gone into bringing them back here. But at this point in time, we've got our hands full with trying to just get one species sorted.
Dean Maxworthy speaking to Amy Briggs. And we've had bird flu on the brain these past couple of weeks, Robin, but you have a story on bird brains.
Yes, last week we heard from Professor Carlos Loess about finding the part of the brain in tiny Australian birds called zebra finches, where their song is stored. They can operate on the nerve cells and remove the song, which persists somehow as a completely distorted version. But after 2 weeks, the song returns somehow again, and this knowledge may help humans afflicted by, say, strokes.
So what we are interested is in knowing, these animals, in a normal situation, they are able to maintain the information about this behavior, which is the song, for many, many years. So the strategy that we are following is, if we experimentally perturb the activity of some of those neurons and then we see how the behavior, the song, changes, so we can do experiments that obviously for ethical and practical reasons we cannot do in humans, and then we can try to figure out what are the changes that happen in the brain that allow, after different kinds of perturbations, for the memories to be retrieved and corrected. So, for instance, we know which are the parts of the brain, which are the neurons that are critical for the production of this song, and we can manipulate their activity very, very precisely with genetic methods. So, for instance, we can do experiments like this. We can either silence the neurons, and then let's say that we silence 50% of the neurons in the brain. And then some of the experiments that we have done show that the song breaks down, but in a relatively short period of time, just 2 weeks, the song comes back virtually identical. Now, what we want to do with those type of experiments is that to figure out how the remaining 50% of the neurons that are still active, how can they make do with just half of the population of neurons? How are the remaining neurons literally picking up the slack, taking into account that the other ones are gone?
So some neurons teach the other neurons.
We don't know. That's a possibility. But going back to the question that I was telling you before, there is something that is very interesting, which is for 2 weeks, the song is very, very broken. The song doesn't sound like the original one at all. There must be mechanisms in the brain that can detect that there are some errors, and then those errors are changed slowly, meaning over 2 weeks, so that after 2 weeks, the song comes back almost completely normal. Now, there is one experiment that we did that is very, very surprising and is a bit difficult to understand, which is we have the animal, we confirm that the song is fully degraded, and now for 10 or 12 days, we prevent the animal from singing. So the animal is not going to sing at all for 10 days. It's going to be in its cage, quiet. And then after 10 or 12 days, then we allow the animal to sing again. But remember, we put the animal in the cage not singing after we had confirmed that the song was very degraded. Now, we put the animal in a situation is the animal starts to sing again. And then what we found very surprisingly is that the song is mostly recovered, even though for 10 days, the animal did not sing at all.
Without practice, it recovered.
Without practicing. That's right. Okay, so then this would be the equivalent of, imagine that somebody is a, let's say, a concert pianist, and then they get into some car accident and they are in the hospital for 2 months. And in those 2 months, let's say, let's just make it very dramatic, which is actually happens quite often. Let's say that somebody is in a coma. And then after coming out of the coma, the person has not practiced in front of a piano at all, but it's able to completely perform to the same level that he was performing 2 weeks before the accident with no practice in the middle. So this is what you would call offline practice. What do I mean by this? Like one of the big mysteries of the brain is that we spend approximately a third of our lives sleeping. And we don't really know exactly why we sleep. But one thing that we know, in particular for humans, is very obvious, is that our brain is actually extremely active when we sleep. And everybody knows that we have dreams and replaying many of the things that have happened during the day when we are sleeping. Okay, curiously, many animals, including some birds, when they sleep, they replay the activity of the neurons that is necessary to produce the song, but obviously they are sleeping. They are not producing any sound, but they are replaying in their brains the sequence of activity of the neurons that if those animals were awake, it would be necessary to produce a song. So then it's very interesting that perhaps the reason that the animals are able to recover the song after this very drastic manipulation of activity is because it happens offline, without practice, perhaps when the animals are replaying, let's call it, dreaming of their song when they are sleeping. And even though they are not hearing any sounds, because the animals are not singing at all either, maybe there is something that we are trying to figure out in the brain that just based on detection of the activity of the neurons, the brain can tell if that pattern of activity will produce a correct song or a mistaken song. And this is actually something that is less crazy than it sounds. Professional musicians, for instance, if you give a professional pianist a piano that makes no sound at all, and they practice, I mean, it's going to be silent practice, they know if they are making mistakes just based on the movement of their fingers. They don't have to hear that the song that they are playing is wrong. There are many things that the brain can monitor about the activity of its neurons that it doesn't require the outward behavior. Just the internal activity of the brain is something that probably the brain can detect.
How is it done? And where, pray, is that memory, say, of music stored? Professor Carlos Lois at Caltech. Okay, so let's ask Dr. Christopher White, who's at Sydney University and who's just won a prize from the Royal Society of New South Wales.
Now, when it comes to studying brains, it's become more and more unlikely, I must say, because when you interview people about how brains work, for instance, how memory works, is it a matter of proteins in particular cells? Is it circuits? And when I walked around Vienna after, I lived in 1955, suddenly German came back. Where has it been stored?
So I think what you're getting at is a really interesting tension in the study of neuroscience. So we often all start out in neuroscience because we're in some sense interested in ourselves.
And what we end up studying are the dynamics of single cells, which are mathematically actually really quite well understood. And now I think the challenge of 21st century neuroscience is bridging from all of this wonderful information about cells and proteins and neuromodulatory dynamics up to psychology. And so you asked, where is memory located? It's probably distributed across the brain.
That's a wonderful answer, yes.
Yeah.
And your own line, now you're about to give a talk, and congratulations on getting one of the awards from the Royal Society of New South Wales. And your talk involves having people look through a little set of colours. For what reason?
Yeah, so I am very interested in building mathematical or computational models that are kind of constrained by the state of the art in experimental neurobiology, but can nevertheless be used to simulate things that a perceptual psychologist might be interested in. And so the reason I focus on perceptual psychology in particular and perception is because it's, of all the areas of psychology, it's pretty easily quantified. And so we can simulate these remarkable perceptual paradigms, and that's where the glasses come in, that can be done in both animal models and in humans. And that gives us an ability to constrain and test our models at both very fine level of neural detail and in terms of behaviour.
So how can you relate all that to the way people behave?
Yes, I think so. But I think I want to be very clear about the modesty of what we're doing, where we're really just targeting perception in a laboratory setting where perceptual behaviour is quite law-like and easily quantified. And I think that's where the science is at the moment.
But you build on that. There's another puzzle I was always bringing up in the science show, and that is, if you think about the way the nervous system operates, and someone, a very, very fast bowler,
yeah.
Stark, for example, comes hurtling at you, and the ball comes out at how many kilometres per, you know, amazing speed, and somehow you have to react, and somehow that transition in the body makes things occur, especially if you're a brilliant cricketer like yourself.
Behold to assume an Australian is a brilliant cricketer. I think what you're getting at is, in some sense, a very large amount of the information processing that the brain does is unconscious. And it has to be unconscious because conscious processing is pretty slow. And so if you, one of the things about becoming an expert in something is, in some sense, actually, you start out with a routine that feels very deliberative, and kind of probably learning to ride a bike or drive a car is something, and a good example of that. And it becomes so well rehearsed that it can basically be taken over by unconscious machinery. And so we all probably have the experience of, whether we like to admit it or not, zoning out when we're driving home and finding ourselves in our driveway. We've just been kind of mind wandering the whole way. And yet we were actually relatively safe that whole time. We didn't crash the car. And so what is it going on when you kind of get a cricket ball hurtling towards you at 100 kilometres an hour? I think there's probably some unconscious processing going on that allows you to catch it potentially. And if you're not an excellent cricketer, get hit by it probably.
Good answer.
Christopher White, University of Sydney, and an award winner from the Royal Society of New South Wales. Next week on The Science Show, we bring you slime and seismology, as used actually in Antarctica. And from you, Bell, advice on calcium intake and flatulence? Sorry, that's the health report. The rash.
It's What's That Rash? You can look up those episodes on ABC Listen. And I'll be filling in for Priya Alexander this week and next on The Health Report. The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Belinda Smith.
And I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.